to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now, here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated specifically to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, the secret societies, and the ancient Holy Grail mysteries. The Guardians of the Holy Grail was created by me some time ago in order to clear up many of the popular misconceptions regarding the Holy Grail mysteries, the bloodline from Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and the Knights Templars and the Freemasons. There seems to be a lot of popular myths that are surrounding these subjects, and so it's my goal to kind of set the record straight with hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as testimonials from current and past members of the Knights Templar and other initiatic societies. I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, which was founded to revive the mystical rites and the wisdom of the original Knights Templar that over the centuries has either been lost or ignored. You can learn more about our Gnostic Templar organization if you visit our website at www.gnostictemplars.org. There's all kinds of information there, and you can find out what we're currently up to, which partly is working towards the reunion of many of the initiatic societies around the planet, so we can support each other as well as the movement, the mass movement towards enlightenment on the planet right now. During the show, if you'd like to call in with questions about our topic for myself or our guest, please call toll-free at 866-472-5795. Today we'll be talking with an old friend of mine, author Nicholas Mann, about the sacred geometry that was used in the original plan for the streets and buildings in Washington, D.C. In his book, The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C., Nicholas contends that the original plan of Washington was focused upon the Capitol building, and it incorporated the golden proportion, which had been incorporated in sacred buildings around the world since very ancient times in order to keep them in harmony with nature. Apparently, this original plan of Washington, D.C. was diverged from at some point, and this has had the effect of throwing off the balance of the city as well as possibly the entire federal government. And so we're going to find out about that and what we can do to remedy this situation. Nicholas currently lives in Glastonbury, England, and is the author of many popular books, including The Isle of Avalon, Sacred Mysteries of Arthur and Glastonbury, Sacred Secrets of Glastonbury Tour, The Dark God, A Personal Journey Through the Underworld, and a book he wrote when he and I were briefly roommates in Sedona back in the 1980s called Sedona, Sacred Earth, which I think is probably still the definitive book about the ley line configurations and terrestrial landmarks here in Sedona. Greetings, Nicholas. Welcome to the show. I bet you were back in Sedona right now. I understand you've been experiencing a pretty deep freeze out there in Britain.
We've had snow like we haven't had for years.
Well, I can't say I'm sorry for being where I am. Yeah, it's been tough here. We've been suffering through 60-degree days and bright sunshine, but we'll continue to tough it out, so don't worry about us. As with all your books, Nicholas, I've been excited to get through this one on Washington, D.C. It's full of amazing information. And I guess you did the research for this book while you were living in Sedona, is that right?
Well, actually, Mark, I went to live in the States in 1988, and I lived for the first few years in Sedona. But in the early 90s, a partner of mine had to go over to the East Coast to spend time there, and I went with her, and I had 6 months over on the East Coast, during which I was able to get down to Washington, D.C. I was actually living in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and the library staff there were fantastic, and of course, the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. was fantastic, too, and they opened up their facilities to me. And I had a wonderful 6 months doing the research. I mean, people had always said to me, hey, you're going to Washington, D.C. It's your kind of place. It was designed by Masons. There's all sorts of sacred geometry. And I would say to them, that sounds fascinating, but where is it? Where is this information? And nobody could point me to the information. So I began, I think, with a tabula rasa, very much like the architect Lanfranc, who designed the original city. I had to start right at the beginning, and the facilities were wonderful.
So you really started your research in regards to Lanfranc and his vision for the city in Washington, D.C. itself, is that right?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, lots of source material, lots of historical information, lots of written documents. I mean, it was wonderful to go to the Library of Congress. And when requesting letters, say, between Jefferson and Lanfranc, to my surprise, to be given original copies. You know, I never expected access to that kind of information. So, you know, it was a chance to study the period, the time of the foundation of the United States, an opportunity to look at the foundation of the capital city. And at times I wondered what I was doing. You know, I wasn't an American. If anything, I was being really cheeky, coming in and thinking that I could say something about this period. But people have said to me that it took an outsider. It took somebody from outside with some geomantic training to look at the situation and get a hold of it.
Well, it took us in Sedona, someone from outside Sedona, to tell us what we had here. So we thank you for that.
Well, the native people knew it all along.
Well, they weren't talking about it if they did. And in fact, what you came up with has been confirmed a couple times or a few times by the Native Americans here. So you definitely tapped into something very, very significant. And we are very grateful for that. Let me ask you, when you were doing your research in Washington and this information was opened up to you, did you feel like you were kind of being subtly guided by spirit to maybe come across something that other people hadn't and maybe to ultimately write about it?
Oh, Mark, that's always a difficult question because, you know, as well as the facts in the library, you've got to get them right. You know, if it's 1792, you can't go saying it's 1793. There's a world of difference. But once you get the facts right, then, you know, the right brain, the other hemisphere, comes in. Intuition. And, of course, being open to any guidance that's available is always so important. And I felt I wouldn't have been able to have done the work I did without that guidance. And you can call it what you like. I mean, it might just be intuitiveness. But you know what I think it was? I think it was the same spirit that inspired Lanfranc. You know, they were there. These people, Ellicott, Lanfranc, the black surveyor and astronomer Benjamin Banneker, who helped lay out the original plan for the city. They were all there at a time when there was very, very little on the ground. You know, it was a very muddy, foggy kind of place, cold in the winter. Georgetown, of course, was there, but not much else. And but I think they were inspired. You know, they rode over the land. George Washington came down a couple of times, rode with them. I think they even got Jefferson out once or twice, but I don't think he really liked it. I think he was more comfortable theorizing than actually getting to grips with the reality. But mind you, he always had to keep an eye on the budget. But anyway, thing is, I think long form, fresh from the American Revolution, fresh from the War of Independence, he fought at several crucial wars against the British. He was alongside Washington. They became friends. He was an engineer. He was captured, I think, at the Battle of Savannah, and imprisoned by the British for a while, but then released. And he was enthused by the vision that was to become the United States of America. It was the vision that was enshrined in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, fantastic documents, documents that really led democracy forward as far as the world was concerned. And he was full of it. You know, he'd come from France, he'd seen the American Revolution or the tail end of it, he'd served in the military in France, and he was a volunteer in the American Revolutionary Army. And so when the time came and the arguments had been settled about where to build the city, and it did come down to Washington, he was filled with what I think was a visionary idealism. And as he and others went over the land, they saw the city of the future. They saw something that the critics couldn't see, which was a vast, visionary city.
So, Nicholas, what was LaFont's vision for Washington, D.C.? What did he want to make out of the Capitol? He incorporated a lot of sacred measurements and so forth. What was his grand vision of it?
Well, you see, this is the question. You know, this is the big question mark, because if you look through the material, if you look through the letters, there's no evidence of the kind of, you know, mathematical approaches that were taken by architects in America at the time, or in Europe at that time. L'Enfant himself wasn't a Freemason. There were very few Freemasons around D.C. at that time. And I really had to come to grips with the question of where did the vision come from. And I really had to make sure that what I've just said, that the Masonic involvement was as small as I eventually concluded, and I had to be very, very, very thorough about it. And, you know, because, of course, you can go on the Internet today and all kinds of people are saying, oh, the Masons did this and the Masons did that, and you can see patterns in the streets. And though it is true that the Masons did get their hands in later, especially in the design of some of the key buildings. After all, that was a major Masonic ceremony, both laying the cornerstone of the Capitol and of the White House. And the Washington monument is thoroughly Masonic, but we're looking at something that was designed decades and not completed, you know, for many, many years after the time of L'Enfant. So at L'Enfant's time, 1791, 92, 93, this period, he ultimately went to what we would call esoteric sources. Sources that might have been available to some Masons, but not all of them. I mean, let's face it, most Masons at that time were lawyers, bankers, merchants. They weren't really interested in the esoteric side of things. He went to some esoteric source, contacted it, and the patterns, ultimately, the golden section patterns that you mentioned, came through a visionary connection with nature.
We have a caller on the line. Deborah, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's your question, Deborah?
Oh, I had spoken to Mark a few moments ago. I didn't think I could make the show, but I was born in Washington on a ley line down from the White House. My grandfather was the commandant of the Knights Templar Temple. It runs in my veins, in my DNA. I know it well, all the symbolism, and I grew up being nurtured by my grandmother and grandfather in that symbolism. And I've never been able to find any information on the exact ley lines, which I'm very curious about, and would love to know. Maybe it's your book, The Sacred Earth, I'm not sure, that has that information.
Well, take a look at my book, The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C.,
and
you will see that in the original plan, the main centers all ran through the Capitol building.
Of course, I know. I've been to all the major buildings. I worked on Capitol Hill. I've been to L'Enfant Plaza many times. Everything centers around the Capitol. It's an amazing, amazing place to grow up, especially with that history. And interestingly enough, I went on to paint the Sacred Angels of the Magi and link the Magi with the Gnostic Knights Templars, and my art is about the Divine Feminine. Little did I know I would end up doing that, so I'm very fascinated to hear whatever you have to say about Washington. I also lived in Old Town Alexandria, where George Washington left his mark, and I lived in a house that Charles Lindbergh used to live in, who was a Mason. I don't know if he was a Knights Templar. But I just brings back all the symbolism to me listening to you. It's amazing because it's the most fantastic city.
Thanks, Deborah. You see, L'Enfant designed the city to be focused upon the Capitol building.
Yeah.
And the original plan called for avenues named after the states to radiate outwards from the Capitol building and thus symbolically link the United States, the different states, with the federal center.
Oh, of course. How interesting. And they all radiate out in a circle, yes.
Yeah, this was the original vision. But what subsequently happened was that the monumental focus of Washington was transferred to the Washington Mall, and especially to the axis through 16th Street and the White House that goes through the Washington Monument and the Jefferson Memorial.
Yeah.
And this took the center of focus away from the Capitol and placed it on what I call the presidential axis.
Yeah.
With the result that instead of the city looking outwards to the country and the rest of the states,
it looked inward.
All the federal buildings turned to look inwards, at federal symbols, and especially the symbols of the presidency.
Yes. And why do you think that was?
Well, you know what? I don't think any committee ever got together and said, look, let's take the power away from the people, away from the democratic principles enshrined on Capitol Hill, and let's put all the power in the executive, in the presidency. But history dictated to America the need for strong leadership.
Yes.
Now, at times with Lincoln and with Roosevelt, the leadership was needed. And a lot of power was given to the executive. So architects naturally tended to focus that symbolic energy on the presidency, on the figurehead of the country. But in fact, attention should go back to the Capitol. And in recent years, there have been plans to revivify the city by going back to Longfellow's original ideals. The mall is now considered congested. It's too crowded.
Yeah.
There isn't room for any more major monuments or memorials. These now need to go in other locations in the city so that the whole city opens out again to the nation, to the country, and the Capitol is restored as the center.
How interesting. And then we have Roslyn, Virginia, across Key Bridge.
And again, it's important that all these places are connected back to the Capitol. And, you know, for example, we can visualize these alignments, if you like, running back to the Capitol, to the centers, to the symbolic centers of power. And by holding, you know, good thoughts, by holding prayer, by holding light in these centers, then the visionary ideals that were grounded at these places can be kindled and kept burning.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you so much for coming on, Deborah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deborah.
Nicholas, I think what's interesting is when there was the major change that occurred in the structure of the city, so it was focused more on the Washington Monument, the monument was actually apparently set right in the middle of a Latin cross. It kind of makes you think that maybe there was maybe some kind of fundamentalist Christian influence there, especially when you consider that the obelisk itself is a very much of a male energy focused on the White House, a male energy, and we're talking about a movement that worships a male principle, if you will, a God in the heaven. So all this kind of makes me feel like there might be some kind of that influence going on, especially when you consider that the Capitol seemed to be more of a female influence in a way. And at the very top of it, of course, you have the Lady of Liberty up there. And so it almost seems like it's gone from a goddess focus, which was, of course, the pentagram, to the God focus, which was more male, and now it needs to return more to a goddess focus. Have you thought about that at all?
I think that's a very interesting analysis. I've found the history of the goddess Columbia amongst the early settlers on the East Coast to be a very, very interesting, very rewarding history. These early female figures, Columbia being perhaps the most, among the earliest, but then Lady Liberty, and of course, eventually her manifestation in the Statue of Liberty, up there in New York, and the Lady of Liberty, the Lady of Freedom, this huge bronze on top of the Capitol Dome. I think it's important to look at these symbols. And you quite rightly point out that they're connected with stars, with pentagonal, golden section symbols, and these stars appear on the symbols of the Lady of Freedom, and of course the stars appear in the flag of the United States. And this is the geometry that L'Enfant relied upon. This is the geometry of nature, that came out of his visionary experiences in the city. And I think he, like a good geomancer, like a good architect, he tuned into the spirit of the place and let its energy emerge. And it was an ancient sacred place, the Potomac River there, top of the Chesapeake Bay, had long been used as a center by the native peoples in the area. And Jenkins Hill, the hill on which the Capitol now stands, was considered to be a council place. So somehow L'Enfant was able to put aside his European, perhaps even his patriarchal upbringing. He was a rebel. He was an anarchist. He wanted a plan that he called wholly new. You know, he wasn't a Christian. He wasn't a Mason. He wanted to break away from stifling traditions and come up with something new and powerful and strong in which, you're absolutely right, the feminine was balanced with the masculine.
Do you think that he was aware at all of creating a kind of a interconnected sequence of pentacles radiating out from the Capitol building, as you've drawn in your book?
Well, he must have been, because if you take the Capitol building that he established as his center, he wanted to run the new zero meridian through the Capitol building. The zero meridian that runs through Greenwich here in Britain, through London. He wanted to shift over to the new world. So zero longitude, was to run through the Capitol building. And from the Capitol, all distances were supposed to be measured. Now, if you take that as the center and then run the avenues out from the Capitol till you come to the squares, the next set of squares, these include Judiciary Square, where originally the Supreme Court was to be located, the square where Union Station is now located, and other squares, you'll see that these can be described by pentagonal geometry. And interestingly, the distance to these squares is about 0.6 of a mile. And we begin to look at golden section numbers here. Then if you look at the next set of radiating avenues and their squares, where the White House, or as it was known then, the President's House, was located, you'll see that it's 1.618 miles from the Capitol. He was deliberately using golden section geometry at this point, but for some reason, he kept it secret. He couldn't talk about it. Perhaps because he was working intuitively, perhaps because he was so ahead of his day, and he was using concepts that other people, you know, had yet to put down into words.
I think it's a bit telling in a way that you've got five pointed stars emanating out from the Capitol, and in ancient times, the five pointed star is the symbol of the goddess, especially the creative power of the goddess, where you've got one point of an inverted five-pointed star that's pointing at the White House, and the inverted star often associated with the destructive aspect of the goddess. It seems like there's a message there, perhaps. What do you think?
Well, the five-pointed star is full of golden section numbers, golden section ratios, and this is the form of nature, the generative principle of creation. So it's the first outbreath from the unmanifest source. It's, if you like, it's the feminine creative principle rather than the inner spark or primal fire. So it's the form of creation. Now, as the numbers and forms associated with creativity, they are always in a ratio to themselves. They are self-referring. So the generative ratio proceeds outwards from 1 to 2 to 3, but at that point the ratio is such that it can stop at that point. It doesn't have to go on to 4 or 5. It's self-referring. It can always refer back to its source. So I think what Longform was doing wasn't so much putting in pentagrams, one way up or the other, as in later occult practice, but he was using them in their purest way as a self-referring system. We have a similar thing occurring in nature with fractal geometry, where things are always referring back to themselves. And I think this was the power of his vision, because he was able to take the driving force of the American nation, which was the people, we the people, the democratic force of the people, run it through the laws, the legislature, the judiciary, the principles that then structure and order that as the second set of principles. And then with the executive, the president, the third principle, he was taking it back again to the source. So you go from 1, which is the people, to the many, the people, and referring back through the judiciary and the legislature to the presidency, who in his single figure comes back to union. So 1, 2, 3, 1. Do you see what I'm saying, Mark? That the president embodied all the people of the nation in his single figure, and so united them again in the harmony of his body. I mean, in a way, this is very ancient symbology. It's very close to what they were doing in pharaonic Egypt, and of course, with the principles of the divine king in Europe. You pluribus unum, out of many, one. And Longform is literally translating that through the three branches of the government.
Well, I think that certainly the inverted pentagram can simply represent the male principle, and it's focused right at the White House, indicating that that is the headquarters of the male principle, and the upright pentagram representing more the female principle radiating out from the Capitol. I know that in Freemasonic lodges, they often unite the two together in the center of kind of their alchemical lodges to represent that alchemical force that's the union of the male-female principles together. So it doesn't have to necessarily be a destructive energy, although the male energy tends to be more that than the female energy does. I think it's interesting that they would have made the headquarters of the National Armed Forces to be a pentagram, the Pentagon, when, to my mind, I always tend to associate the pentagram more with the goddess energy, which is more balanced, which is more peaceful, more loving, and here they have associated with destructive energy of the armed forces. I think that's part of what has given the pentagram a bad name amongst people, and amongst conspiracy theorists, the pentagram thus becomes something dark and and something negative and something associated with war and destruction.
Yes, isn't that interesting that the Pentagon took that geometry and turned it around? I really don't know what to make of that, Mark. The Pentagon is built outside of the geometry of the original city. It doesn't square with it, doesn't integrate with it at all well. It seems to be something out of place. You know, I think America would be better off going back to the center of the city for its symbolism, its inspiration, and its energy, and looking to other places. I mean, I mentioned that L'Enfant intended the new zero meridian to go through the Capitol building, the center of the democratic principles of the nation, and that didn't happen. And what did happen, though, was that a zero milestone was set up on the 16th Street White House-Washington Monument axis. I think it's in the center of the ellipse, just south of the White House. And indeed, that for a while, that whole axis was to become the new meridian. I think 16th Street might be even called Meridian Street for a bit, and there's Meridian Park just north of the White House. That didn't happen. The zero meridian stayed in Britain. But nonetheless, the zero milestone has stayed in the ellipse, and all measures from the Capitol are taken from that point. And to my mind, that's a mistake. I think that is a mistake. That's an example of making the masculine axis, the male axis, top heavy. And you know, to my mind, that milestone should be moved back to the area of the Capitol, or possibly even better, to Lincoln Square. Lincoln Square over in to the east of the Capitol is a very neglected part of the city. And this was meant to have had a very strong geomantic focus, and it never really happened. The area was supposed to become the commercial center of the city. It never happened. It became a residential district. So I think it's important to move symbolic locations over to the eastern shores, the Anacostia shores of the city, and I think the city plan is now considering this.
Well, what surprised me a little bit, Nicholas, is why they didn't stick with L'Enfant's plan that incorporated the golden proportion. You say that he had to be very secretive about it, but he was working amongst many Freemasons who must have known about the golden proportion, and certainly Thomas Jefferson must have incorporated himself as being an architect in his own right. So it just surprised me that they wouldn't have known about it, and that later on they would have diverged from that original focus. It just surprises me, you know.
You know what, Mark? I think what happened was pragmatic issues caught up with them. I think Washington, you know, he couldn't go to the Capitol as much as he would have liked. He was just too busy trying to hold the nation together, and so was Jefferson. I mean, money was a problem. There were tremendous political issues threatening to shake the whole nation apart. You know, all the issues of the Civil War were there at that time, and they weren't resolved. And I think what happened was that money, the budget, simple planning restrictions meant a lot of what L'Enfant designed couldn't happen. And there were accidents. So it's sort of a great visionary plan was put into the hands of, quite frankly, some very mediocre architects who made errors who were limited by the budgets, who couldn't get the labor they needed, couldn't get the investment they needed, and many, many things went wrong. You know, and around the turn of the century, of course, not this century, but the last century, 110 years ago, the central area of the city was in such a mess. The mall, the glory of the city now, you know, was built over. I think it even included a red light district. And it took a planning commission, the Macmillan Commission, many, many years to sort things out. And they went back to the L'Enfant plan. You know, they did their best to reinstate, to bring back the original principles set down by L'Enfant, but already mistakes had been made, buildings that couldn't be removed had been erected. So this central focus on the Washington Monument occurred. You know, it seemed the obvious thing to do, but it's now time to take that focus away from the center of the city and turn it back outwards. And you see, this is the vision. This was the original vision of the founding fathers. This was about connections. You know, democracy was meant to work through communication and connections. And the avenues were meant to be symbolic representations of the connections with everything. Well, those avenues didn't simply stop at the states they were named after. Because after all, you know, the states themselves now reach to Alaska, to Hawaii, to Guam. We're looking at worldwide connections. And that visionary geometry at the heart of it, that five-fold golden section geometry, is the ratio that tunes the United States in to the rest of the world. It's a remarkable geometry. It can bring the United States into harmony with the rest of the world, provided those key principles of freedom, democracy, liberty are really, truly held at its heart.
Well, obviously, the Freemasons that erected the Scottish Rite Temple in Washington, D.C., were well-versed in sacred geometries. So why do you think that they chose the site that they did in order to erect their temple, being right smack in front of the White House?
Well, that is an interesting question, and I speculate about the temple to the north of the White House, up on there on 16th Street. Is it up near S Street? Somewhere up there. Beautiful building, modeled on the mausoleum, isn't it, of Halicarnassus. It's a cube with a pyramid on top, lots of interesting numerology in the steps, the numbers of pillars, and of course the design inside the temple. And it's located in a way that implicates it with what, geomantically speaking, you would say would be undue influence upon the White House. So it does smack a bit of the boys getting together in their ceremonial hall and influencing government behind, you know, round the back door, as it were. And so, you know, so you can speculate on that. You can look at those locations and think, you know, they're trying to get influence. But you know what? Everybody was trying to do that. You know, not just the Masons, but obviously embassies, the federal you know, institutions and other bodies. Everybody was jockeying for a place in the city. So I end up not reading too much into it. And I think it would be a mistake to do that.
Well, so you believe that it's not going to take too much transitioning, too much destruction and rebuilding in the nation's capital in order to return it back to the original plan?
I think the visionary symbolism of the plan is there. I think it's recoverable. The key is to think of the city radiating outwards rather than looking inwards. There's a question I sometimes ask Americans I meet. I ask them, you know, which way does the Capitol building face? You know, where's the front door? And they think about it for a minute, and 9 times out of 10, they say that the Capitol building faces the mall. It faces the Washington Monument. It faces in to that center of the city. But of course it doesn't. The front door, the entrance to the Capitol building, faces away from the mall. It faces out from the center. The same, of course, with the White House. The main entrance to the White House doesn't look down to the Washington Monument. It looks north, outwards. And, you know, to my mind, when you inaugurated your last president, Barack Obama, you had the inauguration ceremony on the wrong side of the Capitol building. I know the space on the other side probably didn't permit such a ceremony to take place, and tradition has always located it in this place, but it was in the wrong place. It needed to be at the entrance to the Capitol building so that the energies gathered could look outwards to the rest of the nation, instead of, again, focusing on the Federal Triangle, the Federal Cross, the Washington Monument, whatever you want to call it, at the center of the mall.
Well, if those changes are made and everything's facing more outward, again, how do you think that's going to affect the federal government? How do you think it's going to affect our country?
Well, I mean, we're talking symbolism here, Mark. So when the kids go to Washington, D.C. and visit it, they're not just going into a mall and looking at monuments that reinforce the notion of centralized power. They're going to a capital city that, where the whole symbolic sense is of radiating outwards, of energy radiating outwards, connecting the country, free nation, free peoples. These are the sorts of principles that I think the capital city needs to hold. You know, in Lincoln Square, whose geomantic significance is enormous, you know, I find it very significant that it has the Lincoln statue of Lincoln, the Emancipation Monument, Lincoln freeing the slaves. You know, this is the kind of energy that needs to be reinforced, and perhaps if statuary or other symbols could be introduced into this area from other parts of the nation, perhaps if native peoples could be persuaded or be invited to take part in monumental projects that introduced native symbolism into this part of the city, then that would go a step of the way towards the original, restoring the original vision, the original principles on which the United States was founded. It's all about going back to the original source, the moment of creation, getting the young people tuned into that energy, getting them believing in those high principles that, you know, your nation has struggled for and fought for and bled for, but getting it in the right place, getting it grounded, getting it opened out and flowing in the right way. Because for too long you've been top-heavy, you know, you've been governed by bureaucracy, often, frankly, incompetent. And it looks inwards, and it now needs to end that phase of introspection and really take its true place in the world and look outwards.
That's a wonderful vision. One more question I have. Do you think that when they chose the location of the capital, do you think it was actually set on a legitimate vortexual area, the confluence of ley lines, and that actually a lot of the avenues that were then set into place were aligned with legitimate ley lines?
You know, I've explored that in my book, The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C. I find it fascinating, you know, as an historian, to come up with the sort of evidence that you would find associated with ley lines and the kind of energies you're talking about. There's a wonderful story of the treaty oak that has a great myth attached to it of that a great chief had his seat of power under an oak in Washington, in what is now Washington, D.C. And from there he looked out upon his land. And one day a woman was captured in war and brought to him. She was a very beautiful woman. And the chief demanded that she become his wife. And she refused. And he said, okay, you don't have to become my wife, but from now on, you cannot leave the shadow of this great tree. So this woman was free, but in the shadow of the tree. And this tree later became the treaty oak, under which it was said the native peoples of the area signed their treaties with the settlers, and under which, you know, George Washington and Jefferson and so on, did other treaties. Now, this legend, true or not, is a powerful symbolic myth of the sort you always find around a cosmic center. We're looking at a tree of life, a world tree, a cosmic axis. We're talking about the shadow of the tree, the alignments that extend out from this according to the position of the sun. This is the kind of thing that indicates there are energies in Washington, D.C. that are older, rooted in the earth, and can cooperate favorably with the human.
Thank you. Well, to kind of wrap up our show, which has really been fabulous, I really appreciate your incredible information. Just wanted to mention a couple things coming up, like the tour that you're going to be working along with my wife in this coming July, 18th to the 24th in Glastonbury, called The Sacred Journey of Initiation to Avalon. You can sign up for that tour if you go to www.sacredsitesjourneys.com. And so I guess you're going to be playing a special role in that on that tour, Nicholas. And if people have questions left over from this show, they can ask then. Huh?
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you then. We'll be looking at traditions of the Holy Grail and so on in Avalon. And I'd just like to say in closing that today, as you're probably aware, is a very significant day, as I think about 11 o'clock your time, there's an eclipse, and it marks the beginning of the Kumbh Mela, the great festival in India that millions of people go to. And the festival, this particular one, is the Maha Kumbh because of the particular astronomical alignments that are taking place at this time, including the eclipse. And it's when the drops of Amrita, the drops of heavenly nectar, come to Earth, and they can be accessed by humans. And this is the kind of tradition we'll be looking at, the heavenly dew that Joseph of Arimathea brought from the Holy Land in the cup used by Christ at the Last Supper. The Rita, the Amrita, the Soma, the food of the gods.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I totally spaced that out. I guess today is the Kumbh Mela in Hardwar, in northern India, and they say that that's when the Ganges turns into Amrita. And of course, that's why everybody is very determined to get there, even if it means risking their life. I mean, it's not uncommon for thousands of people to get trampled to death, but I guess if you die in a sacred place, then all the better. So thank you for bringing that to my attention. I totally spaced that one out. And unfortunately, it's another Kumbh Mela I'm going to miss. I've been trying to get one of those for years now. Have you ever actually been able to make one?
I haven't been to one in India, but we'll be celebrating here in Avalon.
Okay. Well, then we'll be celebrating here in Sedona as well. And do you see yourself coming back to Sedona anytime in the near future?
Oh, Mark, I would love to go back to Sedona. I really enjoyed my time in the States, but at the moment I've taken a vow to not fly. So I don't know how long that vow will last. It's definitely holding up at the moment. So unless I come by ship and then overland, I've got no plans to come back
okay.
your way.
Well, if things changed, let me know. Please let me know. Because certainly it would be wonderful to see you here in Sedona. And if you get too cold, maybe your vow will change. If you get another one of those, those deep freezes, maybe things will change.
All right, Mark. Thanks very much.
It would be wonderful having you on the show, Nicholas, and hopefully we can have you on again and talk some more. You've got some great ideas. So
okay.
Thanks again.
You're welcome.
And next week, we're going to have James Wasserman, who was an academic, a great scholar, a Templar scholar, a Freemason scholar, and he's written a number of amazing books, The Illustrated Guide to the Knights Templar, and perhaps the only book related to the Templars and the Assassins and their relationship. And we're going to be talking a lot about that that relationship next week. So same time, same place next week. Come on back, and we'll have a lot more interesting ideas to float by you. So in the meantime, always remember that the Holy Grail is always right inside of you. Bye for now.